Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with OS Ahmed, software developer. OS, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I follow your content. I'm currently reading your book, actually. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And I had a lot of trouble pronouncing your name, and I never would have guessed the pronunciation based on the spelling. Do a lot of people mispronounce your name when they first meet you?
Yes, and now I've preempted meetings when I'm introducing myself by just telling people, think of operating system, the letter O, the letter S, you say them quickly, OS, you have my name.
There we go. we're talking right now because recently I put out a call to have more junior developers on the show. And before we started recording OS, you did a really good job of kind of like capturing why that's a good idea. Can you kind of restate that for us? What you were saying about like how we have these really experienced people on these kind of podcasts sometimes, but maybe it's helpful to hear from people who are earlier in their career.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that we were speaking about is that there's wonderful content out there to help people who are looking to transition from whatever career they're currently in into the software development world. And that's wonderful. I'm glad we have that content. And I think there's a lot of discussion and content about how people can level up and get to that senior level. I haven't found information about how do you, once you're in, what can you do to get to that intermediate role? So like that ladder from junior to intermediate and to the seniors. So I think it'd be nice to have a perspective on from juniors about what it's like to be a junior and what they're doing to try to level up or what they'd like to see more of out there.
Yeah. And can you give us some idea of where would you put yourself right now and how long have you been programming and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So professionally, I would say it's been almost 2 years, but the first year of professional work was, you know, kind of piecemeal work. Like I worked for a small company doing a few jobs here and there. So officially for a year, I've been doing it. So I have a year of experience working with Ruby on Rails for one single company. So I would put myself as still a junior, but, you know, it's funny to say when I first joined, you know, I was a junior and it's a year later. I'm not the same developer anymore, but you're still in that junior approaching that intermediate stage, but there's no clear distinction where you can say, oh, I'm an intermediate. And maybe there never is, but it'd be nice to see more resources to say, okay, here's some things you can definitely do to make yourself, put yourself in that role to be an intermediate.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like a really subjective, mushy thing. Like, when do you go from being junior to intermediate to senior or whatever? Like, it's really unclear.
Mm-hmm. And some of the distinctions, from my understanding, because there's a lot of information about intermediate to senior, is that some of those skill sets aren't always technical. There's some soft skills, managerial skills, understanding what to delegate, understanding the business needs when you're moving to that more senior role. But with the junior to intermediate, I feel like if there are some soft skills, what are they? If there's some technical skills that are, you know, language agnostic, what are those things that make you an intermediate as opposed to a junior? Or I like the term I heard, and I think it was from the Rails 5 podcast. I probably got the name wrong, but I know Charles Maxwood was on there, or it's his podcast. It was about the advanced junior. We're still junior, but you're further along your career as a junior. And I think that requires a lot more discussion and guidance on what to do to get to that intermediate stage.
You know, something that just popped into my head, maybe somebody goes from junior to mid-level or whatever you want to call it, when they can go, when they're at the point where you can give them a job, give them a task, and trust that they will be able to complete it without a lot of hand-holding. So, like, there's a stage of development where you give somebody a task, and you not only need to specify what to do, but how to do it in fairly great detail, or else the person will just get 30 minutes in and then just be completely lost. And that's fine, because obviously everybody has to go through that phase before they get to the next phase. But one possible distinction between junior and whatever the next level is after that is when you can give somebody a task and just know that they're going to complete it. The code might not be amazing, but they'll at least get it done and it'll work, and then you can come back and help the person refactor it or whatever. What do you think about that?
I think that's a good metric for determining if someone's an intermediate. But immediately I started thinking of some questions. There's a lot of external factors. So let's say this is a junior who's transitioned to a new position as an intermediate in a new company. For them to reach that stage of being able to just complete something without any handholding or any guidance into how to do it, they would really have to know the code base that they're working in. So they may understand maybe the syntax, the proper ways of writing clean code, but if they're not aware of all the associations in the models, if they're not aware of, you know, what service objects do what, it may look like they're not an intermediate because they don't know those things. So I think it also is incumbent on companies to make sure that when they onboard someone, that they onboard them in a way that allows them to succeed. And I think a lot of companies do that. But I mean, I think that's a factor too. So it's one of those things where even though you may be able to do those things, it may be dependent on where you are. If you stayed with the same company for a couple of years, you may be able to do that well before you're at that stage of where another company might call you intermediate. So I guess the other thing is, do you know your code base well wherever you are? But also, if you move to a new company, you will not know the code base that well. So it'll take time for you to ramp up to be an intermediate. And then different companies have ideas of what being intermediate is, which is another confusing. And I'm sure it's the same thing with seniors. But I think what you said is a good barometer if you're able to do that.
Yeah, and you did have a good counterpoint there, because like by my own metric that I just said, I would have been a junior developer at my last job that I had for the first few months at least, because I was pretty much useless on my own at the last place I started for about the first 3 months. Just because of there's kind of two things. There's the particulars of the code base itself, and then there's also just the domain. This was I just was completely unfamiliar with the domain that I was working in, and so I could hardly do anything by myself. I needed to ask people for, and you know, there was a lot of tribal knowledge in the organization, and so if there was something that I needed to know, the only way for me to get that information was to go ask one of the more senior developers, or not more senior, go ask somebody who's been at that organization for a long time in order to get that information. I guess in order for that metric to be valid, you'd have to put an asterisk on it to say, like, in general, like if you're building something from scratch, if you can give somebody a task and say, like, hey, here's a new client, they need a scheduling system, can you build this rudimentary scheduling system on your own? If they can do that by themselves without any outside help, then that's like a certain, that to me is like a meaningful distinction in your career, when you can go, when you can build any reasonably not complex, but like any reasonably like easy feature, you can build it completely on your own. That feels like a milestone in somebody's career to me.
Yeah. But that, and that's true. It just made me think about when you, you know, for someone who's self-taught coming in and getting a role, joining a wonderful team and, you know, being able to learn from and continue to learn from them. When you're a junior developer and you're approaching the interview, there's many times when you realize there's so much I don't know. And initially in the early stages, when you're thinking, okay, I'm in the company, I'm starting to write code, I'm starting to become a little bit more independent, then you start hitting these more challenging things and you realize, okay, I really don't know these things very well. And then you start to doubt yourself and you think, well, what do I need to know? So I think it'd be nice. And I know it's, maybe it's not possible because I love recipes. So I like steps and instructions. So being able to tell someone, okay, here you are. And here are the certain, so let's talk about Ruby on Rails developers. Like for me, as I'm, you know, increasing my knowledge base, I'm starting to realize if I was speaking to a junior developer, very junior developer, and telling them, what do you need to know to get to where I am? I think here are some things you need to know. So I would say understanding how testing works. So that's the thing right now I'm really focused on, getting better at writing tests. So whether it's RSpec or if you're using mini tests, you really need to understand it, because understanding the right tests will make you a better software developer. Doesn't mean you have to know TDD, but I think that's something we could tell juniors or people who are entering the industry. Understand tests, their importance. You have to follow TDD all the time. But that's, so to me, that'd be like one of those things you need to know. But also, you know, understanding more about the tool you're using. So if you're a Ruby on Rails developer, you do need to know how Rails works, really works, and understand that there are nuances as well about whether a company wants to use service objects, whether a company wants to implement different design patterns. But those are things you won't know when you first join. But I think those are some of the things you need to know in order to get to that intermediate and eventual senior stage. But I think initially when people are learning how to become a developer, and I'll use Ruby on Rails, it's like, let's build this CRUD app. But the real world, and you're, when you join a company, yeah, there's some things that involves CRUD functions, but there's so much other stuff that goes on that you won't know until you're in a company that allow you to learn those things. So I think that's a dialogue needs to happen when people are transitioning and they finally get in there saying, okay, now you're here. This is very different than what you're doing at home when you're building, you know, a to-do app.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you mentioned about testing, I think people reach a whole new level when they start to do automated testing, or when they start to get proficient with automated testing. Because when you write code with tests, it's not like just an extra little thing that you add to your workflow. To me, it's an entirely different way of approaching programming. And it makes a total difference in the results and everything. And similar to how a developer reaches a meaningful inflection point when they start to get proficient with automated testing, an organization whose development team practices testing and their code base has good test coverage is a much different organization than one that doesn't, I think.
I agree with you.
Yeah. So, okay, something I want to ask you. You mentioned something about like wanting to level up from junior level to mid-level or whatever, and maybe it's unclear what resources to turn to and stuff like that. What if I just say like, oh, well, like what's so hard? Just like there's some books and stuff, like go read those books and you're good. Like what's the big deal?
Yeah. And I think that is an approach a lot of people may take. And I'm lucky where I work. I have a small team. There's three other developers who are seniors and I get mentorship. So I know I'm in a position where I'm lucky. But, you know, when you're trying to level up outside of work and you're thinking, okay, these are things at work they're telling me to level up on. What are things outside of work on my own time that I could work on? Yeah, there are books, but you have to know what books to read or what concepts that you need to understand to be better. So if you don't know that, you can just be grabbing, you know, every book you see thinking, okay, I should read this book, I should read that book. And, you know, you stretch yourself too thin in terms of what you need to know, because what I'm starting to understand from my mentors is that, you know, or even like, you know, from the Michael Hartl, his series about just learn enough to be dangerous. You don't have to know everything. You will never know everything. But if you can focus on the right concepts and get good at those, that'll help you get to that next level. So when I just grab books, I'm lucky that, you know, I am active. I go on Twitter. I see what people are suggesting. I find people who are blogging. You know, that's how I found you as well, and other people that I follow. So I'm like, I'm putting myself in a position to find those things. But for some people, they may not know about it, or maybe they may not be the type to be active online. How do we help them know those things. And I think that's where the issue is. There are books, there's plenty of books, but which books will help you?
Yeah, that's a good question. One way, you know, I could like say specific titles and I probably will, but like one heuristic that a person could use is like, okay, so here's how I think about books in general, like technical books and non-technical books, is like, I tend not to read new books because, well, you have limited time in your life to read books. Like, you're not going to be able to read 10,000 books in your life. You can read maybe like a few hundred, or if you're like a crazy voracious reader, maybe a couple thousand in your life max. And so you have to be really judicious about what you choose to read. And so I tend to not read new books because those books haven't yet been filtered out by time. And so if there's a book that's 10 or 20 or even 50 or 100 or more years old, and it's still around and people are still reading it, it's probably a pretty good book. And so I tend to favor old books over new books. It's a little tougher to apply that to programming because programming changes so much. But there's a lot of stuff in programming that actually doesn't change all that much. Because like the technologies change, but the principles don't change all that much. And so that's one piece of advice I would give, is like try to favor old books, like read the classic programming books. And the other one is to favor principles over technologies. Again, because technologies change, but principles tend not to change, or at least they don't change as quickly. So having said that, a few of the books that I've enjoyed that are kind of classics are, one of the best ones I've ever read is Refactoring by Martin Fowler. It's pretty easy to consume because it's not like you have to understand this whole like large arc of the book. It's like these, you can understand each chapter individually or each example individually or whatever. That one's been great. Clean Code by Bob Martin, I got a lot out of that one. And then in the Ruby world, Practical Object Oriented Design in Ruby by Sandy Metz, I thought that was a pretty good one. I'm trying to think. Right now, I'm on my second attempt of reading Domain Driven Design by Eric Evans, and I'm almost done with it. It has only taken me like 2 years to get like 7/8 of the way through the book. It's kind of a difficult read. And then Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture by Martin Fowler. That's a good, pretty much anything by Martin Fowler is pretty great. I don't know. So those are a few like principles type books that I've read that have been really good. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Well, I guess I'll leave it at that. Those are the ways that I at least think about which books to read.
That was a great list of books. And I agree with that. But I think, let's say someone who's a junior, who's like they graduated from a boot camp, or they're self-taught, or, you know, they graduated some post-secondary and they got their first job. They may not know about those books. And there's a lot of books to consume. But those are helpful. And I guess the question is, when you are approaching those books with your skill set and the experience that you have, how do you approach it? Do you take notes or just read it the way you would read a book? Like, how do you take what you need from there and help you grow as a developer?
If I were a better person, I would take notes when I read books, but I don't. Not because I don't think it's a good idea, but just laziness or whatever. I'll just read it like regular. There have been stretches of my career. I go through like oscillations in my career. So like there'll be a period where I like read a bunch, and then there'll be a period where I like don't read at all. And then I go back and read a bunch, don't read at all. I go back and forth like that. During the periods when I read a lot, sometimes I'll like take the first hour of each workday and just sit at my desk and read a book for like an hour, a technical book. And I will admit something that hopefully is encouraging to other people. A lot of times when I read a technical book, I do not understand it or even come close to understanding it at the first pass, or maybe even ever. Like patterns of enterprise application architecture, I can say that I've read that book, but only in the sense that I've looked at every single page and I've read the words on the page. That doesn't mean that I actually grasped the meaning of what I read. But sometimes you go through these books and you read them, and then, like, you know, 6 months or a couple years later, somebody asks you a question, and you're like, oh, that's the blah, blah, blah pattern. And then you're like, whoa, I didn't realize that I knew that, but apparently I know that. And so even though it seems like that stuff isn't, like, actually making it all the way into your brain at first, sometimes it actually is. And a lot of the time it actually isn't, but that's fine. I think sometimes people buy these, like, books, like Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture. They buy them for, quote, reference. But to me, it's like, how are you ever supposed to reference these books if you don't know what's in them? So you have to at least take a skimming pass through them one time so you can kind of familiarize yourself with what's in it. Because otherwise, you know, if you do that, then you can, like, you can be coding and you come across something and you'll be like, oh yeah, I vaguely remember something that was kind of about this in this certain book. I'll go take a look at it. But if you never, like, skim the book in the first place, then you, like, don't know which book you need to reference or whatever. So it's kind of useless in my opinion. Yeah, but that's kind of my approach to reading.
Yeah, thanks. It just made me think about what you said, the honesty of that. I'm currently just about finishing The Well-Grounded Rubyist. And there was a few chapters that I came across where I said, yeah, I read that whole chapter and I'm not sure. I'm going to have to go back and read that chapter. But that's okay. I just wanted to read it to familiarize myself with certain concepts so that when they do come up, I can say, oh yeah, I remember reading about it. Now I know where I can go find it if I want to learn more about it. So I'm probably going to read that book again, but not read it just to get through it, but maybe focus on certain chapters that I think I need to know more about, or, you know, something in there that thinking, well, hey, I am writing a blog post. Let me find some content that I can use to help me write this blog post. And I just realized why I wanted to come on here. One, you know, I admire you and I wanted to come on here on your show. But when there's a lot of seniors who come on in podcasts, they don't remember what it's like to be a junior. So it's hard to be able to put yourself back in that shoe and say, here are the things that I struggled with or I need to know. So why I wanted to come on here, and I hope other juniors do, is to shed light and give perspective on what it's like to be a junior trying to make their way up, because our challenges are fresh. They're there. So in a couple of years, I won't remember what was challenging or what I needed to know. So I think that's why it's important to have junior developers also speak about and write. So when I write blog posts right now, I stopped writing when COVID started, and I'm getting back to writing it again. I realize why it's important to do that, because the things that I will write about will be very beneficial to someone who's junior or new, because I'll be writing from a perspective that's not so far removed from them. Whereas when a senior writing it, I'm not saying they're not capable of, but they may not realize what would a junior need to know. What are the things that I've struggled with? So I think that's why it's important to have the variety of perspectives.
That's a great point. When I first started trying to teach Rails testing, it was really hard for me because I was like, well, I don't get it. Like, what's so hard? You, like, write the tests and then you're all set. Like, what's so hard for everybody who doesn't know how to do it? And obviously, like, I'm being a little bit facetious, but not very. Like, I remember my first attempt at a Rails testing project or a product was in, like, the summer of 2018. I launched this Rails testing course. I might have talked about this on the show before, but it was a terrible course. I really didn't know what I was doing. I sold it for $50. Two people bought it, and one of the two people asked for a refund because he said he didn't learn anything, which he probably didn't, because there was barely anything in the course and it was presented quite badly. But yeah, that thing that you bring up, the curse of knowledge, is certainly a real thing. When you're super experienced, it's really hard to remember what it's like not to have all that experience. Luckily for me with the Rails testing stuff, as I've gotten more and more practice teaching it, I've gotten reminders from people like, oh yeah, like FactoryBot, like what is FactoryBot? Why do we use it? All this stuff. And so I've gotten to a place where I felt like I could be better at teaching it. Okay. So what, now that you mentioned that, what are some of the things that you might find yourself facing challenges with at this point in your career?
Yeah. It's for me, like I said earlier, writing tests has been like the focus, because initially, some of the projects I've worked on, it required me modifying a test, which is a lot more, is different than writing a test from scratch. So let's say you create a new feature. And then I remember I was working on a service object. So I was working on this feature from beginning to end, and the service object was quite, you know, it did a lot of work. Like it took in a CSV file, checked the headers, and it would update the user model. And that wasn't the problem, but writing the spec from start to finish, you know, I had to think to myself, well, what do I need to test? You know, why am I testing these things? What do I need to mock or stub? And that, you know, when you haven't done it and you just modify tests or written simple tests for like a CRUD app, it doesn't really prepare you when things get complicated or when there's something that involves timestamps and you need to like freeze something. If you've never done that before, the concept could be very challenging. You think, well, wait, how do I test this when, you know, there's a variable, which is the time, and it's time sensitive. And those are things I think, you know, you have to remember when you start learning tests, that the tests you write initially in some of the apps that you're practicing on are not what you're doing in the real world. Like, they give you some idea, but there's a whole level of complicated. I'm not trying to scare people, but testing can get quite sophisticated if you want to write robust tests that make sure that whatever you're putting into production isn't going to break or cause bugs. So that's something that I'm trying to learn, is to write really well-written, efficient tests, like not over-testing, but writing the correct test in that scenario.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because testing can get pretty serious, and there's a lot of cases where it's really unclear exactly how to do it. That case you bring up is a pretty interesting one of like modifying an existing test. That's not something that I've thought about very much as like a learning challenge that people have, but I can see how that would be challenging, because like maybe you do some practice on your own, writing tests for CRUD features, all that kind of stuff. It's all greenfield. And then you come into this existing app and you have this big complicated test that's testing this big complicated piece of code, and you need to change it somehow. That's a whole different thing.
100%. And sometimes you're working a code base that's 5-6 years old, and they may have written tests differently 5 years ago. And then you're coming into it thinking, okay, I'm pretty good at RSpec. Let's do this. You look at the test and you think to yourself, whoa, this does not look like RSpec. and then you have to understand, well, that means you have to understand what tests are for. Why do we write tests? And when you're running a test, what are you actually testing? And once again, when you're in a tutorial, it may give you an idea of what to write for a to-do app. But when you're in an application that's moving, there's a lot of moving parts, that's very different. And I think that's something I would love to let other juniors know, or people who are entering the industry, learn your tests and be prepared to level up your testing, because it's going to be very different in a production app.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that particular thing is something you want to get deeper into. I don't know how, I don't know if you know of a specific example or anything like that, but I'm open to talking more about that one if you want to, or if there's other stuff that you want to discuss, I'm open to that too.
Yeah, I think we could circle back on that, because I guess I want to talk about some of the things that, I guess, from a developer using Ruby on Rails, what are things, if you're a junior, you should probably know, like writing tests are important, understanding how jobs work, because there are not many times do you deal with jobs in tutorials or books that I've encountered, but then once you're in a production-ready app, understanding the importance of jobs. So you have to kind of understand how an application works. So I think that's another place that I think would be helpful for someone trying to move up, is once you understand like the basics, there are some other parts of the Rails or any other framework you're working with that add a layer of, you know, complication, nuance that you need to know. So I would say understanding how jobs work or asynchronous work works, because you don't want your client sitting on a browser waiting for something to happen when you can just do it in a background job.
Mm. Okay, so this is another one where it's like, to me, I'm so familiar with it that it's hard for me to imagine not being familiar with it. And so I think like, mm-hmm. What's the big deal? You got these jobs, you call the job executes, that's all there is to it. So like, can you help me understand like what challenges you might have had around jobs?
Yeah, so the first time, you know, I remember, and this is not long ago, working there at work, just trying to build something out, and then someone mentioning, well, you know, if there's gonna be a lot of requests or a lot of things that need to happen, maybe we should do this asynchronously. And I thought to myself, oh yeah, that's a good point to bring up. But when you're just working on your own tutorials, building these small apps, that never crosses your mind. So it sounds simple, and the implementation is not complicated itself, but understanding, oh, this is something that's important, I should know this. So the next time I'm building out a feature, I need to think about, well, how is it going to be used? Is this something that's going to be instantaneous, or could this take time and resources that we don't have right now, and we can just put this into a job and have it run later on? So I think that's what it is. If you're not introduced to it, then you won't know about it. So it's that whole idea of you don't know what you don't know. And that's, yeah. I think that's a lot of it is for juniors. You don't know what you don't know because you've not encountered them in projects. Or maybe this could be specific to me, or I'm sure there's other people who are dealing with it. Because like you, when you're in school, when you put your hand up, you're not the only one who has that question. So if I'm thinking, well, I never encountered jobs until then I'm sure there's some other people. Or maybe not. Maybe it's me.
No, I'm sure it's a widespread thing. Definitely. Yeah. What was I going to say about background jobs? Oh, yeah. A big part of that might be like, you know, here's what I was going to say. There's like a pedagogical challenge with some of this stuff where, like, for people writing tutorials, like, first of all, writing tutorials takes a long time, and even relatively elementary stuff, the tutorial ends up being pretty big. And so it's like to get into all the nuances of it is just like impractical. And so what we end up with on the internet is all this shallow beginner level content that doesn't go into any real depth. And that's not like a criticism of the people producing the content. It's just, first of all, it's not practical, but also there's not really like it's the payoff isn't worth the work a lot of time, because the further deeper you go into stuff, the fewer people are going to be consuming that content. And so it's kind of a problem, and it's a problem that will probably never be solved just because of the natural forces involved. There aren't incentives that force people to write content that goes into these deeper levels. I think the thing is, like, the only way, unfortunately, people are going to learn a lot of that stuff is getting on a real production project and getting production experience.
You're absolutely right. I mentored for a boot camp in Ottawa called Lighthouse Labs. And one of the things I would tell some of the students was, you know, you're going to learn a lot in the boot camp. You're going to learn a lot on your own. But where you're really going to grow is when you're working on a team, building a production-ready app, and you have mentors. So the other thing I would say for our juniors is, if you're lucky the way I'm lucky to have mentors on your team, utilize them. Because they'll be able to help you level up and learn. So I know I'm lucky, but I'm at a point right now where I can say, okay, what's helping me grow? You know, some things I've encountered, I mentioned, like getting better at testing, you know, being introduced to concepts that are going to push you outside of your comfort zone. But also mentorship is one of the biggest ones. But also getting a job in a company is another huge task that I think is also very challenging, because there's people who can't even get in their foot in the door. So they're not going to be able to level up the way they want to because they don't have that kind of experience yet.
Yeah.
But to read. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say that's a huge one. And like getting a job where you work with like really smart people who can help you get better makes such a difference. Because if you work at a place where like they do everything sloppily and stuff like that, you yourself aren't going to get better that much faster. It's hard to get better in that kind of environment. And if you work somewhere where everybody is really smart and they follow good practices and stuff like that, you're just going to get better so much faster. But it's hard.
100%.
It's hard to find yourself in that situation, because you don't know. Like, you could interview, if this has happened to me, like you interview for a place and they seem great and then you start working there and it's actually not great. So it's not always easy to tell from the outside.
Yeah, so how do we help? I guess my thought process is, I used to coach basketball and I used to help kids with their homework. So I like to be able to help other people. And the reason where I'm here in this place where I'm now a developer is because, you know, countless people on YouTube, countless blogs, countless books. So I'm self-taught, but I've had hundreds of teachers who don't know about me. And I want to be able to help other people. So that's why I was blogging before. And that's why I'm here on your podcast. But what, besides helping that junior go to intermediate, how do we help people who are on the outside, who are still trying to get in, still continue to level up? And I think having this conversation and talking what concepts that they haven't been introduced to because they don't have a job in a company working on a production app will be helpful. So maybe someone listening will say, you know what, I've never really used a job before. And I do use Ruby on Rails. Let me jump in and see what jobs are. Maybe I can build a side project that incorporates that or demonstrate that I know what it is. So I think that's an important thing to make it easily accessible by bringing this information. Saying, here, you can come on this podcast and hear a few ideas of what you need to do.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I was cyberstalking you a little bit before the show on your LinkedIn profile. You went to college for like history and political science, is that right?
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to be a teacher. So when I was a teenager, I loved history. I had some really supportive teachers. And I was a youth worker at that time. So I coached basketball, 18 under girls, 18 under boys, helped kids with their homework. I said, this is a natural fit for me. I want to teach. Got to fourth year, realized, I don't know if I want to do this. So I actually left school. I just traveled, you know, I had kids. And then when I decided to get back into, you know, figuring out what I wanted to do, I was taking odd jobs at that time, working at a residential home, working at financial services, got my mutual funds license. And then I said, you know what? I love development. I need to find a way in, but I didn't want to go back to school. And then that's how I got into it. And then it was a long process. And I was lucky that I had a lot of opportunities where I had one job where I was on customer success, but they knew I wanted to be a developer. So they gave me opportunities to work on side projects. And that's where I started to read about Ruby on Rails. So it's very unconventional the way I kind of did things. And then then a couple of years later, I was at where I am now at Lingo Live. And it's been good, but there's a lot of challenges along the way.
Okay, so this is off topic, but there's some of that story that we just can't skip over. You said you did some traveling. Where did you travel to?
It was in the UK for a couple of years.
Okay.
So England, mainly England. Yeah, and a little bit of Scotland.
Oh, then, interesting.
Yeah, and then I was back in Canada after that.
Okay. Was it London or some other part of England or where?
It was a small town, Somerset County. So it was like a very, very small town in England, Burnham-on-Sea. I was there. Don't think most people have heard of it, but it's very small.
Okay. And how did you end up in that particular place?
Oh, at the time I was with my partner at that time. We were just living over there. They had family over there.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you came back to Canada, and by the way, if people didn't put it together already, they probably heard you say process, and you revealed yourself as a Canadian when you said process. So the reason I ask about your background is because, did you find it hard, or how hard did you find it to get that first development job, not having a CS degree or anything like that?
It was fairly, and I want to be honest about it because I don't, you know, there's a lot of people, I see people posting, you know, you grab some books, teach yourself, and there's jobs waiting. I heard so many no's. I took so many take-home tests. I literally would go to companies in Ottawa, knock on their door and say, I'd like to apply for a development role. And they'd ask me, do you have an interview? I said, no, but I know you're hiring. And I would get interviews. I wouldn't get the job. And then one of the companies I ended up working for was a health tech company. And I came in for a front end role. At that time, I wasn't really working, learning the back end. I learned a little bit of Node and Express. And they said, well, we're a Ruby shop. And they interviewed me right on the spot. They said, we're a Ruby shop, but we like you. So why don't you come on as a customer success agent? And then you can level up and work on some side projects. So I created, I created an opportunity for myself. So I wasn't a developer, but I got to see what it was like to work with the development team on some side projects. And I was really, really, I think that really helped me eventually get a full-time gig, because I could put on my resume, yes, I was a customer success agent, but I worked in these small side projects and attended a few hackathons at work and outside of work.
Yeah, that's so great. And I really respect and admire your approach that you took with that. I was talking with somebody else on the most recent podcast that I recorded about his path to getting his first development job. It was very similar from the sounds of it. He had to apply to a lot of places and get rejected a lot of times before he finally got his first job. And with me, it was a little bit similar. So I didn't go super deep into my whole story on the last episode, but I was super lucky in that my dad is a programmer. And so I was exposed to it really early. I started programming when I was like 12. And then I actually worked for my dad for like 2 years. And it's funny because it was like, he was paying me like, to start with, he was paying me like 10 bucks an hour. So like absurdly low compared to like what a real programmer salary should be. But it gave me a little bit of practice. Looking back, like my dad never actually like taught me anything about programming, which that's a whole different thing. But I at least got to have a tiny bit of programming work experience. But okay, so that was from age like it was like 14 to 16 or something. Like I was super young. And then when I went away to college, I thought I could get a programming job pretty easily, but it turns out that like nobody cared about my 2 years of experience working for my dad because I was just 18. I didn't have a degree or anything, like, and the little experience I had counted for very little. So I applied to a bunch of jobs and most of the time I didn't get an interview. And most of the time I got an interview, I didn't get the job. But then finally there was one place where they actually interviewed me twice. They interviewed me and rejected me. And then some months later I applied again and they interviewed me again. And that time they hired me. And so I think it takes like a, well, one thing that I want to communicate to people if they're not already aware is just having realistic expectations about how easy it's going to be. Because it probably won't be easy. I think even for people with a CS degree, it's not always very easy to get a job. Because quite frankly, when you have a CS degree and that's all you have, you're not very useful yet. Because you don't really know anything that's relevant yet. Because the stuff you learn in school has very little overlap with what you're going to be doing in an actual job.
Yeah, and I tell students, like some people in my neighborhood who have university age students who are in computer science programs, I'll let them know, get some internships. Like that'll be the experience that you need that'll help you when you're graduating. Because it's that first job. I think there's a huge demand for seniors and intermediates or seniors and above. Like that, once you're at that level, I imagine from just my readings, jobs. Getting another job is not a problem. But when you're a junior or you're not even a junior, you haven't even gotten your first job, that's the hardest stage to get your foot in the door. And yeah, and so setting a realistic expectation. So I've had friends reach out to me who aren't able to find a job and said, well, how did you do it? And I'll tell them, it takes a lot of work. You have to apply to many, many places. You're going to have a lot of take-home tests. And it's unfortunate, but if you really want to do it, that's kind of what you have to go through.
Yeah. Yeah, and people complain a lot about those take-home tests, but like they have to evaluate your abilities somehow. And so that's pretty much what you have to do in order to get the job. And it's not like uncompensated labor. Like that's the wrong way to look at it. It's not uncompensated labor because it's not like they're turning around and using your test work and like committing that to their production repo or something like that. They just have to assess you somehow. And yeah, I've done those. I've had experiences even late in my career where like I was given a test and I just like couldn't figure it out. And I had to go back and be like, sorry, I guess we're done because I couldn't figure it out. But a lot of it, so something that I tell myself or that I've told myself in the past when I was looking for jobs is eventually somebody will be dumb enough to hire me. And it's true. Like if you just apply to a whole bunch of stuff, it's never going to be the case that you apply to 1,000 jobs and you don't get hired, you know? Like, so you just have to apply to it. And maybe your first job will be a terrible job, but that's okay because it's so much easier to go from that first terrible job to something good than to go straight to a good job.
Yeah, I think it's important when people are applying is to also be honest with themselves. Like, let's say you hear 100 no's in a row, be willing to look in and say, well, what's going on? Maybe you're not, your skill set's not there. That just means you got to work harder. Maybe there's other things. Maybe the way you're presenting your running a resume. Maybe the way your GitHub is set up. Maybe there's something out there. So it's, I think it's a constant process to make sure that, you know, you're putting your best foot forward. And I remember speaking to someone and letting them know, LinkedIn's kind of important. That's how people, recruiters find you. So if you're trying to get your foot in the door, you need an up-to-date LinkedIn. I think there are people who just don't think about that. They just think, I'll create a resume and just apply on the website. But there's some legwork to do outside of that. That's part of the reason why I started blogging, was to teach other people, help simplify things that I'm learning, but also reach a broader audience. Because I've gotten interviews, and my last job, I got it, the current job that I have right now, I got it because of, in a way, from blogging, because they were on the platform advertising a job. And I would have only known about it because I was a blogger on that platform. So it exposed me to something. And when I was a mentor at Lighthouse Labs, they found my blog post and they reached out to me because they realized that I was self-taught and I'm putting myself out there to help teach other people. Like, I'm not writing the most sophisticated content, but content that people are finding helpful. And I think that's something else that someone can do. Maybe not everyone's comfortable blogging, but maybe find something else that you could do. Maybe try to answer some questions on Stack Overflow. But putting yourself out there will help, even if you don't have any real experience.
Yeah, that's a great point. So like, when people are hiring, my experience at least is like, you have this like pile of resumes or this big list of job applications or whatever. And if you have 100 applicants, you probably don't want to interview all 100 of those people. So you have to figure out some way to filter them. And so you start going through and you look at these people's online presences and stuff like that. And you need a way to decide who's worth interviewing. And so there's like these signals, like, if you have a LinkedIn profile, if you have like your own website, even little stuff like, is your address some personal looking Gmail address, or do you have your own like @yourname.com address? That's another little signal. All these little signals add up. And, you know, frankly, the baseline of applicants is pretty bad. And if you're just like halfway decent, then you're ahead of like 90% of everybody else. Like, if you just do that stuff that's like super easy to do, like having your own domain where it doesn't matter what's on it. Like, if you just go to it and all that shows up is like, hi, my name's OS. Like, you're already ahead of 90% of people because 90% of applicants don't have their own domain. So all those little signals, can add up, and not all of them are that hard to do. And like you said, you know, blogging can help. Maybe not everybody's a blogger. There's kind of a palette of options that people can choose from. You could write blogs. You could speak at local meetups. You can even try to speak at conferences, which is, I think, actually easier than a lot of people might think. You can appear on podcasts like you're doing right now. You can even do something crazy like start your own podcast, which apparently you can do because I did it. And to my great surprise, people actually listened to it. So yeah, I think, like, you know, if you're not well suited to one of those, maybe you can pick a different one. And maybe people feel like they're not well suited to any of those, but it's like, okay, you can choose not to do any of those things, but the more of those things you do, the more of an advantage it'll give you.
100%, I agree with that. I think about some of the people that I admire, some of the things that they're doing, whether they're open source contributors, podcasting, or blogging, and I realized just from hearing them speak that it does offer, it makes it easier in a way because people know who you are. The recruiter has looked at your blog post, or someone on the dev team might have said, actually, you know what? I listened to their podcast. If they're looking for a job, or if they're, you know, they'll reach out, because I've noticed that recruiters will reach out to people. You know, they'll reach out to me. Sometimes they're looking for a senior developer, but I'm like, I'm not looking, but I appreciate that. But why do they reach out? They must have found me on LinkedIn, or they've read a blog post. I've had them reference my blog post before. So those things do help you get noticed. So I think those are great things. And it sounds like it's intimidating, because I remember the first time I wrote a blog post, I was so scared. I said, I'm going to put this out for the world to read. Oh my, what am I going to do? But then when I put it out, I realized, oh, it's not so bad. You know, if someone doesn't like it, that's okay. Fortunately, I've never had someone say, oh, that's terrible. But, you know, I've had people comment and say, oh, you know, this is interesting. Have you thought of this? So anyone who's thinking about blogging that hasn't, especially if you're a junior, I highly recommend it. You know, I've had nothing but wonderful experiences with the online tech world, with blogging, and, you know, occasionally on Twitter. But it really helps you, because when you blog, you're not only reinforcing what you know, but you're also helping other people. So for me, helping other people is a more important one, but it reinforces things. Because there's things that I think, from a junior's perspective, you think you know, and you take it for granted. Like, I'll use Ruby on Ruby. Enums. You're like, oh yeah, I use map all the time. I use each all the time. I know what it is. But then you're like, wait, could I explain it to someone? And if you can't really explain it to them, then you're like, well, I'm just using it because I'm familiar with it. I have a vague idea. But if you blog about it, you got to understand it now. So that was something that I found interesting. And that's really helped me. So if you're a junior looking to level up, start teaching other people. That's how, and that's the funny thing is, I used to play basketball, and I became a better basketball player when I coached. So I think that's the same thing with mentoring. So if you can mentor someone informally by writing a blog post or help someone, that'll make you a better developer.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Like, I've learned so much by blogging that I never would have learned. And like, even still, like, I've been working on this blog post and video about factory bot syntax, and I'm just going like super deep, like right to the bottom of it. Like, how does every detail of this actually work? And I've learned so much stuff, not only stuff that I didn't know, but stuff that I didn't know that I didn't know. And I never would have learned that stuff unless I had tried to teach it to other people.
Yeah, and I think for people who are afraid and who are intimidated about blogging and they don't want to put their content out there, just write it for yourself. You know, pretend you're going to publish it and then write it. You may change your mind and decide to publish it, or you don't, but you still will probably know more after writing the blog post than you did before you wrote the blog post. So I think it's a very, very valuable tool. The one I'm trying to get into to level up and become a better developer is contributing to open source. So right now I've been kind of beating around the bush and I'm nervous about doing it. But I know that's the next step that I need to do if I want to be the developer that I want to be, the best that I can be. I think trying to contribute to open source will be what helps me get there. So what are your opinions on contributing, and how would you get into it?
Oh, that's funny. That's the second time today that this topic has come up for me. And I've only like just barely dipped my toe into those waters. And frankly, I have little desire to do any more of it because it's tough. And it's like a little bit thankless to contribute to open source, at least in my perception and experience. So I don't have a lot of advice for anybody. My small contributions to open source were this. There's this library, I think it's called Devise Token Auth or something like that. Like maybe 5 years or so, I contributed like a few lines of code to that library. And then recently, maybe a year or two ago, I found what I thought was a bug in Rails, and maybe it was an actual bug, maybe it was just a perceived bug, but that felt kind of rewarding just to get at least involved a little bit in the Rails open source stuff. But yeah, I don't have any advice because I haven't really gotten into it. That, you know, on the palette of options of things you can do to help build your authority and skills and stuff like that, I've chosen a lot of them, like podcasting, blogging, making videos, all that stuff. Open source is no thanks on that one for me.
And that's completely fine. Like, I think, you know, I think it's important that the listeners know, like, you don't have to be an open source contributor to be a great developer or to level up your skills. Like, that's not necessary. You don't have to blog. These are all things that you can do. I feel like you should pick some of them, and that'll help. But there's no, you have to do it. The other thing I wanted to mention for junior developers is reading documentation. At first, it can be intimidating. I remember the first time I read I was reading documentation. I said, is this even English? Mm-hmm. Like, who wrote this? They wrote it for another senior developer. This is not written for anyone else.
But I don't know, man. Sometimes that stuff is, it's like, who is this written for and who wrote this? It's like inscrutable. Because, again, it's the curse of knowledge. They can't imagine. And, you know, I think a lot of times, like, the people building these tools are, like, super smart, but among their skills might not be written communication. And so they write these things, and it's impossible. And you write this, and the natural thing to think when you read that stuff is, like, oh, I'm just, like, not as knowledgeable or smart as this person or whatever. But often the truth is that it's just not that well written, for lack of a more charitable way to put it. So I actually have a couple tips for reading documentation for people, which is, like, when you read some documentation and you don't understand it, really try to zero in on precisely what you don't understand. And, like, I will actually, like, I'll zero in on one particular sentence, and I'll read that sentence, and I'll see if there are any terms in that sentence that I don't understand. Okay, right now I'm going to go to some famously bad documentation. I'm going to go to the Kubernetes documentation. Okay, and I'm just going to start reading. Okay, I Googled Kubernetes staging environment. Okay, and I'm going to read from a paragraph called "The Default Namespace." It says, specifying the namespace is optional in Kubernetes because by default, Kubernetes uses the default namespace. If you've just created a cluster, you can check that the default namespace exists using this command. Okay, so that's maybe not super, I happen to understand some of that because I've been studying Kubernetes lately, but first question is, like, what exactly is the default namespace? Does it have some kind of significance? Is it a namespace called default? And if I list the namespaces, will there be one called default, or is it just, like, there in the ether or something like that? So then I might, like, go separately and go, like, Google Kubernetes default namespace so I can understand that part of it. Another thing, you know, I kind of understand what a cluster is, again, just because I've been studying Kubernetes, but when I read that for the first time, I might see, like, okay, cluster, I don't know what that is, and I'll go study cluster. Because, like, when you read documentation, sometimes it's easy to just read a paragraph and know that you didn't understand it, but not know exactly why you didn't understand it. And so zeroing in on the exact parts that weren't clear can be a much more productive way to head toward understanding.
Yeah, and I think that's so true, because I'll go back to the well-grounded Rubyist, like, some of the chapters, like, I bookmarked them saying, okay, I read the chapter, but I need to go back and read it. And maybe, you know, when I go back after having some familiarity with it, I can look into what it is that I don't understand and then focus on that. So yeah, definitely. So for anyone, for the junior developers, it's okay to be intimidated, because everyone to some extent is, you know, they will encounter challenging things, but the important thing is to try to get a better understanding, especially for the tools you're using. Like, if you're, you know, working with Ruby on Rails, knowing Ruby, that's the tool you're using, but also knowing Rails. So reading its documentation, they have pretty good documentation, I'll say, on the Rails documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, one of the books I want to read outside the documentation is the Rails 5 way. I know 6 is out, but the book's not out. So I think I'm okay with 5.
Yeah. Little enough has changed that the Rails 5 way will probably do it. Yeah. Yeah, that's another book where when I first got it, it was Rails 3 at the time, but I laid my eyes on every single page of the book. I didn't understand it, but I at least looked at every page.
But it's really helpful to do that. So I'm juggling, I guess, two books, the last two chapters of The Well-Grounded Rubyist, and then your book that I'm going through right now to help me with my testing. And there's another RSpec testing book that I want to read. So my focus right now is like testing and then writing my blogs again. But it's important, I think, for junior developers to actually read a lot. I think, you know, I don't want to put any unnecessary pressure, but this is an industry where things are changing so much. And you're already starting from a place where there's so much you don't know. And no matter what stage you get in, there'll always be stuff that you don't know, but you'll have understandings of the things that you need to learn and what's important. So in the early stages, I really do think it's important to try to consume as much as you can. So I remember before I had my first dev job, I was listening to as many podcasts as I could. I was, you know, on YouTube watching tutorials. I was, you know, I probably should have created more and watched and read less. So I think that's something I would change if I had to go back, is I would say build more. So read, then build. Watch something, then build something. That would be something I would definitely tell junior developers, is start building things, and then start building things with increasing complexity. So you build a to-do app, good. Write that to-do app with tests. Write that to-do app this time, but add something that, you know, every Saturday it'll run a job and email people on jobs that they haven't finished. And I think those things will really help you grow as a developer. And I would go back and tell myself those things. But maybe it's easy because I know those are the things that I need to do in this position. But maybe I can help someone now by letting them know this is things that will help you.
Yeah.
It's like, sorry, I was going to say, like, there's a book that I'm reading called Peak. It's referenced by, I think Malcolm Gladwell referenced, it's about the importance of deliberate practice. So the idea of building something with increasing complexity that pushes you towards your outside your comfort zone. So, you know, the CRUD app, you know, the to-do app, you know, that's easy. You do it with a tutorial. The second time, you learn about testing and you incorporate testing. The third time, you add some complexity to it or something completely different. But the point is, each time you're challenging yourself and you only get better with that kind of deliberate practice. You can do it in other fields more easily, but you can find ways of incorporating that. So that's why you have to try different things. And I didn't do enough of that early in my learning stage.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes I almost err on the other side too much, where it's like I read a little bit of documentation. I'm like, okay, I'm impatient now and I just want to build a thing, and I try to build it. And then I discover later that, like, oh, if I had just read like the next paragraph, I could have saved myself an hour of extra programming, but oh well. But yeah, I think you're totally right that, like, if all you ever do is read and watch videos and stuff like that, it's not going to get you nearly as far as if you actually spend some time building some stuff too.
Yeah, and you can only build a CRUD app so many times, because eventually you're not learning anything new. So that's why it's important to add those levels of complexity. So look out for them and say, okay, I've built a blog app, but what can I add to it? So you don't have to build a new app. Maybe you just add to this app and it continues to get more and more complex. But if you just keep building that same CRUD app over and over again, you're not going to get better. It's like the whole idea that someone has 30 years experience, they're great at what they're doing. Well, did they have 30 years of the same experience or 30 years of different experience? So that's
Did they have 1 year of experience 30 times?
Yes.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
And so that's the advice I would give to myself. Like, hey, build complex stuff. And if you don't know where to find it, read the documentation, see something that's implemented in there, and say, okay, I'm going to add this to my application. So I remember a few weeks ago, I built a chat app using Action Cable and Stimulus. I've never used Action Cable before, but I wanted to try something different that took me out of my comfort zone. I remember a year ago, I said, hey, I've never built a mobile app. I didn't want to use Swift. I didn't want to use Kotlin. So I said, let's try Flutter. It was something different to make comfort zone. And, you know, I learned something from it. So I think that's something that's important to always do. Build something that you've never built that's going to push out your comfort zone.
That's good advice. And I think that's a good place to leave it. Last question for you, Os. Where can people go to find more about you online?
You can go on LinkedIn. So it's just Os Ahmed. There's not that many people with my name. On Twitter, which I think I'm just Os. Let me just, Twitter. What is my handle?
We can go find it and put it in the show notes.
Yeah, and then also on dev.to / OS Ahmed. So that's where most of my content is. I do have a west.ca, but it's you just pull stuff from dev.to anyways.
All right. Well, we will put all that stuff in the show notes. OS, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on, and thanks for creating this opportunity and platform for people. So thank you.
Thank you.